Today it's my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker, Martha Minow, who is the Jeremiah Smith Jr. Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, where she's taught since 1981. She primarily writes about human rights and advocacy for members of racial and religious minorities, and for women, children, and persons with disabilities. Her numerous books include Breaking the Cycles of Hatred, Memory, Law, and Repair, and Not Only for Myself, Identity, Politics, and Law, as well as several case books on civil procedure and women on the law. She served on the Independent International Commission on Kosovo and helped to launch Imagine Coexistence, a program of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees to promote peaceful development in post-conflict societies. Her five-year partnership with the U.S. Department of Education and the Center for Applied Special Technology has worked to expand access to the general curriculum for students with disabilities. And schools and education is what she's here to speak to us today, and her title today is Just Schools. Please welcome Martha Minow.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan of the center, and actually, I even go to the website all the time, but I learn a lot from the conferences and other events. And it's really especially great to be able to talk with you about some forthcoming work, because I need some help. I have a book that I've edited that's coming out in April, and then I'm trying to write my own book, and I'm stuck. So you're going to help, right? So the book that's coming out in April is called Just Schools, and it's an edited collection of essays looking at responses to new immigrants, largely in the United States. One of the chapters focuses on France. And in this book, we actually try to address what looks like a conjunction or a collision between two ideas of equality. One idea of equality focuses on individual equality, individual opportunity, the opportunity for each individual to become successful in their own definition of success, but also in the society's definition of success. The other idea of equality focuses more on the freedom of groups to be equal in a society. And the way that these two ideas come into collision in schools is pretty obvious. Let me put it in terms of hopes. Adults hope that schools offer each child the opportunity to succeed. But also, adults hope that schools replicate their own culture and tradition. And when you have multiple cultures and traditions, there could be collisions between these two ideas. That's the problematic of the book. And the book's essays include one that studies the reception of Somali immigrants in Lewiston, Maine. Many of you followed the controversies when the Somalis moved there, actually settled by Catholic Social Services. They were originally settled in Atlanta, where they were treated as black, and they didn't like that experience, so they asked to be moved. They were moved to Lewiston, where they were treated as Muslim. That created other issues, whether that shows something about the complexity of identity in America. And another chapter looks at a Muslim school in Chicago called the Universalist Muslim School. And Universalist there refers both to the inclusiveness of that school for all Muslims of all traditions, but also the aspiration of Islam to itself be a universal approach to the world, which is expressed in that particular school in part by the embrace of a particular character education program developed by evangelical Christians in the Muslim school. In addition, there's a chapter, if you can believe it, about Amherst, Massachusetts, where the public school system has a document embracing multiculturalism as the mission of the school, but that doesn't mean there's unanimity. There's a division in the school between what the author, Austin Sarrett, calls hard and soft multiculturalism. The multiculturalism that is a means for ensuring culturally responsive education so that each child succeeds in conventional terms, and the hard multiculturalism and its advocates instead has the view that there are distinctive cultures that deserve recognition and respect regardless of whether or not it advances the success in academic terms or career terms. So these are the kinds of essays in the book, as well as, I say, one that looks at France and the particular issues many of you are very familiar with about Republican ideals and how it's played out in the schools there. My own chapter is what I'm going to talk with you all about, and it's a précis of a book I'm trying to write, and as you'll see, I need some help. So let me just begin with a little story. When a group of parents sought to include their religious holidays in the set of public school holidays, the school board voted 10-0 against the proposal. And when an applicant asked the board of school examiners to offer the examination required for public school teachers on the day other than her religious Sabbath, the board refused her request. And the board also prevailed when she brought a challenge to court. The outcomes are very similar, but the two events, both in the United States, were separated by 100 years. The first case, it was Ida Cohen, who was an Orthodox Jewish applicant who failed in her challenge to Saturday exams for public school teachers. It was a group of Muslim parents who failed to convince the school board in Baltimore, Maryland, to include the end of Ramadan on their school holiday calendar. This was in 2005. So 100 years separate the two events, very similar results. And yet, the second, the more recent event, is to me very surprising, given the revolution that's occurred in the intervening period. Because it's during that period that we've had all the social movements led by the civil rights movement, but followed by others that I'm going to briefly allude to, that have made the recognition of difference, indeed the politics of recognition, as salient in the United States as the politics of redistribution, if I can use those terms, as the two ways to describe the two ideas of equality that I referred to at the outset. So on the one hand, we have with Brown versus Board of Education and the civil rights movement on behalf of African Americans, a rejection of a kind of significance given to group identity that led to segregation. And at the same time, that case, of course, is now claimed by people who want to talk about recognition. It's a paradox. Let me just give you an example. The Harvey Milk School is a school for gay and lesbian and transgendered students run by the public school system in New York City. And it's a school that's provided in part to respond to the violence and abuse that those students have experienced in the other public schools. When the school was expanding a few years ago, there were protests, turns out, from two groups, both of which held up signs saying, we're the true heirs of Brown versus Board of Education. So the people who opposed the expansion of the school said, this is terrible, this is segregation. Brown stands for integration. And the people who advanced the expansion of the school said, Brown stands for equal respect for all students. Now, that kind of dilemma, how do we understand this gold standard of American jurisprudence, is really the focus of my chapter. As I look at how the equality debates in schools have spread from race to disability, gender, and language, immigrant status, and perhaps most surprisingly, religion. So religion is the newest in the series of civil rights claims about how schools should treat difference, and both with the increasing room for public support for private religious schools and the voucher movement, and in the increasing space given in public settings for religion, the framework that has been used by the Supreme Court and lower courts is equality and its equal recognition. And it would be discriminatory to treat religious groups differently than other groups. And many of you I know are very familiar with these developments, but it's surprising, I think, to some who have been preoccupied with the constitutional tradition of separation of church and state, or more accurately put, the Establishment Clause. So on the one hand, we have this expansion of a Brown legacy, which represents clearly a commitment to equality and clearly confusion about what it means. And on the other hand, and here I introduce something that's a separate factor that I'll just group under the general heading of school reform, we have in this country the very first serious challenge to public monopoly over schooling. Yes, we have recognized and preserved constitutionally space for private schools for a long, long time, but only recently have we had massive movements within public schools and outside public schools that now make it possible to have charter schools, magnet schools, pilot schools, many, many, many different kinds of centers of curricula for schooling. Interestingly developed at the same time as we have growing national standards for what students should be learning. We are now, in that sense, starting to approximate what other countries have done. Just talk about this at a national level rather than a local or school level. Not prescribed curriculum for in a place like France, but nonetheless, by having No Child Left Behind and other kinds of national standards, paradoxically, that's opened up room for local experimentation. because if there are outcome measures, then it's much harder to say every student has to be having the same curriculum. There are outcome measures. The question is, what's the best way to teach? And that movement has helped to spur and support the development of many, many different kinds of schools. And guess what? Many of them are identity-based. So, just as examples, we have in Minneapolis two schools that are organized around Arabic. 99% of their student enrollment are Muslim immigrants. They're public schools. They're charter schools. We had a controversy over a similar school, a public school in New York City, an Arabic language school, and that hit the press, and the school exists, but the person who'd been designated to head it had to leave because she used a translation of a word that people didn't like, so this is a sign of the complexity. There's a Hebrew language school that's a public school in Florida. There is also a push by the current administration towards single-sex education. There's a federal regulation that was adopted in October 2006 that turns the corner, actually, from what had been a prior position. The Department of Education now permits instruction in single-sex classrooms in schools and provides money to stimulate the development of these schools. There are now 100 public schools in the country that are for girls only. After an earlier period, when the lesson from Brown seemed to be that integration was the solution, now the trend is instead, well, single-sex education is more effective. Little footnote, the social science is very confusing here. It does seem to suggest that girls, particularly middle school age girls, do better in single-sex education. Boys do better in co-ed education. We have a mathematical problem here. I don't know how we're going to work that one out. But at the same time, it's interesting that concerns about gender equality now are also pointing to problems that boys are having, particularly in elementary school, and justifications for at least educational programs that focus on boys specifically. So disabilities is another interesting area where we have this fight. The Individuals with Disability Education Act quite specifically calls for mainstreaming students or inclusive education to the extent feasible. At the same time, it calls for the appropriate instruction, which points often in the opposite direction. This tension, therefore, over how to translate the commitment to equality and at the same time have some room for recognition of identity. And is that part of equality or is that something else? It replicates itself in each of these areas. And I'll say just a word then about how it is working out in the religious context. We do increasingly have arguments about vouchers or other kinds of public aid for religious schools, but it's all against the backdrop of a big change. The Supreme Court of the United States reversed prior concerns about public dollars aiding private religious institutions when in 2002 it approved Cleveland's use of public funds in the form of vouchers. In that program, to be used only by low-income parents, and in that context, over 90% of the schools are Catholic schools, the justices in the court's majority used the occasion to abandon a previous effort to separate government from religion and to replace it instead with a concern for neutrality towards religion, neither favor nor disfavor religion. Again, social science evidence is extremely interesting. The studies, again, many of you know this, of Catholic schools indicate that if anything, they, in many urban areas, are more diverse than the public schools. And if anything, they do a better job preparing people for civic education, civic participation in the public schools. Not necessarily so true about other religious schools, however. What happens when the vouchers are used in a school that doesn't have the traditions that the Catholic schools have? In particular, the way in which urban Catholic schools have redefined the religion requirement to be quite a different idea. It's not teaching catechism as much as it is teaching about world religions and respect for religion. What happens when the private schools are, in fact, teaching universal Islam or some other tradition quite specifically? Is that something that this country will come to favor? That's not clear. The case, the decision in 2002 was very specifically tied to the details of that plan. And interestingly, the politics then collapsed. Very few communities have followed up and pursued vouchers, and so it hasn't been tested particularly. What's developed instead, which seems to me just fascinating, is how the charter school movement, by which states allow entrepreneurial groups of people to create their own schools, is increasingly the place that religiously motivated people are going to start schools. Groups of ministers and others who have a conception of a mission for education apply for charters and succeed. They have to make sure that the school is open to all and that it is not sectarian. And then there are issues about how to make sure that the instruction itself is not teaching religion. But this is, the cutting edge for religion in schools. It's and a very interesting development, and maybe one more, teeny in its numbers but growing very quickly, is homeschooling, where homeschooling, in fact, doubled in its numbers last year. Still very small, but it's growing very quickly. And homeschooling, not surprisingly, often involves very religious people. Actually, it's two groups of people. It's evangelical Christians and it's hippies who homeschool. Interesting coalitions. I got a call from someone in Michigan who was one in the hippie side saying that she was in coalition with the evangelical advocates for their particular homeschooling bill, and could I have any advice for her about how to negotiate that particular coalition? What does seem to me very striking is, as a public policy, school success is central to individual success in a country, in a world that makes knowledge the key towards economic self-sufficiency, in a country, in a world that makes self-governance central. So school success is absolutely pivotal for any idea of equality or freedom. How much should this society, should any society, similarly make protection of, encouragement of subgroup identity one of the features of group membership, or more basically of individual freedom and equality? The design of these institutional arrangements is going to be crucial here. And I'll just close by saying my own conception is that we have failed so drastically producing equal opportunity in public schools in the country that for anybody to close off any particular options simply because it stands for some symbolic reason as an objectionable practice, when it holds out some promise for improving school achievement, I just think that that's wrong. And that's why I've ended up supporting charters and vouchers, and I've made enemies, and, you know, life is interesting. But at the same time, I do worry about the effect on a culture. If we move from the 9 to 10% student enrollment in private religious schools, which we currently have, to something that's more like 30% or 40% or 50%. And if you start to include not just organizations that are set up as private religious schools, but increasingly these public schools that have a religious character, we may be going down that road. And when you add to it not just religion, but also ethnicity and language, schools that are organized around specific missions that have an identity basis, what happens to the polity? Will we still have a sense of a common purpose? So here's where I'm torn. I'm going to put to you my dilemma. I do believe that there's evidence to indicate this, and it also makes common sense, that schools are more likely to succeed with more students if the teachers and parents have a sense of mission, and a sense of mission and purpose, and it's shared by the teachers and the parents. And therefore, I am tempted to embrace the Let a Thousand Flowers Bloom approach of the school reform movements of our moment. On the other hand, if there is ever more decentralization of the control over the content of instruction, ever more organization of schools around missions that have an identity basis, what are the prospects for forging a common national identity, and even more importantly, a sense of mutual implication in each other's futures seems to me diminished. And this takes me back to Brown versus Board of Education. One of the important insights from that case and social science research before and after it is that simply mixing people in the same building does not change attitudes. lots and lots of ink has been spent on the social contact thesis. Simply putting people in the same building doesn't make them respect each other, like each other anymore. In fact, there may even be an upsurge of negative attitude. What does make a difference is working in common towards a common project. And that's the fear that I have about the trend towards splintered identities. Because where will this happen? Where will students have the experience of being on the sports team, being in a school play, being engaged in a common project if it's not in schools? And so I'll just make, as my last thought, as I travel around the world, talk with people from other places, it seems to me not by accident, places that have the either historic or ongoing risks of inter-ethnic or religious or racial violence are those that have schools that are divided along those lines. Maybe Switzerland is the exception. But if you go to Northern Ireland, if you go to South Africa, these are places that school people differently based on their identity, based on the parents' identity. And that's what worries me about the trend that we have, even though I admire many of the schools that are emerging. I have one more closing thought. I keep having closing thoughts. I'm sorry. A week ago, I was in Hawaii, and I know it's a hard life. But anyway, I had a great time in Hawaii. But this part of the trip really was quite serious. There are, there's been a very vigorous legal challenge to the school there called the Kamehameha School that was set up by the last royalty in Hawaii as a school to benefit Native Hawaiians with a restrictive admissions policy. Admitting only Native Hawaiians. We can talk about how that's defined. It happens to now be a very wealthy school with an endowment of $9 billion, yes, I said billion dollars, and it's turned out to be a very good school. And so, not surprisingly, its admissions policy has been challenged. The district court upheld the admissions policy. The Court of Appeals overturned it. The Court of Appeals decided to rehear it. They changed their mind, and they upheld it by one vote. The Supreme Court was considering the case, and it settled. And it will be challenged again. While I was in Hawaii, I talked, of course, with a lot of people about this school and what it symbolizes. Although it takes a very small number of people, it represents the resurgence of Native Hawaiian tradition and language, even though, until recently, it banned the teaching of Native Hawaiian as a kind of assimilationist project. But at the moment, a lot of the endowment is being used to help support the charter school movement in Hawaii, which now has 20 Native Hawaiian public schools. Whereas the Native Hawaiian population in Hawaii is about 24% of the population, in those schools it's 94% of the population. And the students in those schools are doing much better on standardized tests than their counterparts in the public schools. And as the people designing the schools explain it, these are schools with aloha, which I learned means nothing that we have an English word for. It means love, it means comfort, it means calm, it means embrace. These are schools that are taught with a cultural and spiritual tradition. These are schools that are taught by people who believe in the success chances for the students involved. Why wouldn't you want that for your own students? This is the dilemma that I see. In 1920, when whites moved to Hawaii, they looked at the Native Hawaiians and said, we can't go to school with them, and they segregated the schools. Are we going to replicate those issues again?